be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all this morning, but we have some special guests that I'd like to recognize. First, we have students from St. Francis High School, but I don't think they're in the courtroom. I think they are in the tour orientation room. So you are watching us on TV, and we are imagining all of you. And so I'd like the students who are in the tour orientation room to stand, because that's our custom. And while you're standing, I want to say welcome to the Supreme Court. You may be seated, students. And at this time, I explain that the students are here with us on a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. It's cleverly entitled Court with Class. And we invite students across the state to come and listen to oral argument. And when they come, they meet at noon or right after our second argument with a justice who's been assigned that day to meet with the students. And the St. Francis High School students will meet with me, and they will meet with me in this courtroom after the second oral argument. Now, we have other students with us, and everybody, students and non-students alike, are invited to meet with me after the second oral argument. The discussion will be the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in the cases that we are going to hear today. So let me welcome the Department of Justice interns. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming today. And in what division of the DOJ are you, or are you in several?
Several.
Well, we won't ask you then to state them. I'm assuming that some of you are in a division that represents the DNR. That was a clever assumption on my part in light of the cases. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We hope you join us at noon. And we also have University of Wisconsin Law School students who are here with Professor Justice Lewis Butler. Will they stand, please? And good seeing you all. And which class is this?
This is the appellate advocacy class, Chief.
Okay, good. Well, welcome. And you, too, are invited to our noon seance. Maybe you can be seated.
Seance.
Don't know what I'm going to do today.
Okay.
Excited.
All
right. Now that I put everybody in the appropriate mood, we are going to call our first case, 09AP639, Tracy J. McGreath. Nope. That's the third case.
If you start with Lake Euliff, you'll have a
chance.
Why
don't we do that?
2 out of 3.
Well, that's right. I'll start with the first case, 08AP3170, Lake Beulah Management District versus Department of Natural Resources. And we have a lineup here as follows. 25 minutes for Mr. Kent, 30 minutes for Mr. Lane, 30 minutes for Mr. Cinderbrand, and 5 minutes for Mr. Kent. It's an hour and 30 minutes. All right, let us proceed. Mr. Kent.
May it please the court. My name is Paul Kent, and I'm here today on behalf of the Village of East Troy. And with me at council table is Attorney Claire Silverman of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. The village began the process of siting a municipal well 10 years ago to provide an adequate supply of drinking water for its residents. After evaluating several alternative sites, the village received approval from DNR for a high-capacity well, and it's DNR's 2005 approval of that well that is the subject of this judicial review proceeding under Chapter 227. That decision was affirmed by the Circuit Court in Walworth County and then reversed by the Court of Appeals. There is no question that the village met the applicable statutory standards for a high-capacity well under 281.34. And there is no question that the high-capacity well statute is a graduated framework that reflects careful and deliberative legislative choices to protect both our public water supplies and our water resources. Now, the district claims that this legislative framework should be disregarded because it's not adequate to protect our waters, and that is simply not true. In fact, the kind of graduated regulatory program utilized for high-capacity wells is commonplace throughout our water resources programs. And, importantly, DNR retains ample authority outside of the permit programs to address any adverse impacts to our waters should they arise. Not only would the district's position disregard specific legislative choices, but it would then replace the legislative framework with a standardless permitting process. We believe that the key to this case is a review of the applicable statutes for high-capacity wells, 281.34 and 281.35. And it's important to look at that because it reflects a gradual and graduated framework that reflects careful legislative choices. For wells under 100,000 gallons per day, they do not require a permit. But for wells over that threshold, for many years, the only standard was to make sure that those wells did not interfere with public water supplies. In essence, when this statute started out, it was designed to protect municipal wells from other high-capacity wells. That standard is still on the books today. Then in 1985, the legislature created what is now 281.35. And it did so to regulate for the first time environmental impacts on navigable waters, and it did so for wells over 2 million gallons a day. And those standards reflect the full panoply of public interests. For example, one of the key standards under 281.35 is that no public water rights in navigable waters will be adversely affected. That's the standard when you're over 2 million gallons a day. But then the legislature looked beyond that. In 2003, Act 310, the legislature went back to address potential environmental impacts from this category of wells in between, what the Court of Appeals refers to as middling wells. But they are the wells between the threshold of 100,000 gallons per day on the one hand and 2 million on the other hand. And I think it's important to take a look at what the legislature did. First of all, it targeted additional environmental standards for particular sensitive water resources. It did so for certain kinds of springs. And it did so for certain other kinds of waters and groundwater protection areas, such as trout streams and outstanding natural resource waters. The legislature also established different standards under these provisions than it did for 281.35. Remember, I just said 281.35 was this kind of broad panoply, full public rights, no adverse effect. What the legislature did in Act 310 was to say the standard is that the wells shall, quote, not cause significant environmental impact.
Counselor, does 281.34 sub 4 have an application to this well?
Sub 4?
Yep.
Let me just make sure I've got the right...
The department shall review an application, and it's for a high-capacity well,
yes,
which I think we all agree this is.
Absolutely, and sub 4 is the section that prescribes environmental review,
mm-hmm.
and it prescribes environmental review for those specified categories of wells. The village's well is not in those categories.
Okay, and why isn't the village's well within those categories?
Well, first of all, it is not affecting a spring. It's located approximately 1,400 feet from Lake Beulah, but there is no spring at issue there. Second, it is not in a groundwater protection area. Those areas are statutorily defined earlier in the law as pertaining to particular water resources. Lake Beulah is not within those either. And this is not a case that involves a water loss out of the basin. So the standards in Act 310...
Why doesn't it involve a water loss out of the basin?
Because it is the water that is being pumped from this well is not leaving the Great Lakes Basin. It's actually staying within the Mississippi Basin. So it's not a water loss as it would be, for example, if we were operating a bottling plant and shipping water to around the country. This is not a case where we are taking water, bottling it, and selling it somewhere else. We're taking water, using it for drinking water purposes. There is a sewer system that then treats the water and puts it back into the basin.
But if this water affects Lake Beulah's basin, and from what I understand is not in dispute, it's discharged into what, the Sugar River or some other tributary, I think it was the Sugar River, that doesn't flow back into Lake Beulah's basin. And I think, if it were to affect that basin, then doesn't it result in a 95% reduction in the amount of water that's withdrawn, given where it's discharged?
No, Your Honor, it does not.
Okay.
And these definitions,
why not?
These definitions, again, if you go back to the definition of water loss, which is in 281.34, paragraph 1.
Right.
Water loss means a loss of water from the basin from which it is withdrawn as a result of an interbasin diversion or consumptive use or both. The basins that we're talking about here are the Great Lakes Basin, which applied to the Great Lakes Compact, and the basin, the Mississippi River Basin, which is the other. And again, what we are not doing is we are not taking that water and bottling it and shipping it out of the basin.
I understand all of that. I guess what I'm concerned a little bit with here, given the arguments that have been presented, is why shouldn't we consider the watershed of Lake Beulah as a basin when we're looking at the water being taken from one basin and not being discharged into that basin?
Well, it comes down to the distinction on the term basin, and I don't think that, I mean, what we have is a local watershed, and this statute could have been written to make sure that there is no impact within local watersheds. It did not use that term.
Okay.
It used the term consistent with the way the term has been used by the Great Lakes Compact, which is a much larger system, and the concept in the Great Lakes Compact was, again, taking this water out of the basin and shipping it into a different basin, whether it's by bottled water or by other means.
Okay, thank you.
So sub 4 doesn't apply. Is that your bottom line?
That is correct, Your Honor. And I think it's important to note in that regard that DNR has a rule, NR 150, which establishes categories for which actions require environmental review. High-capacity wells are listed as a Type 4 action, which are not subject to environmental review under the Department's current rules.
Counsel, let's take a look at that rule then. I think it's your position in response to the Chief's question that under 281.34.4, there are three categories, and it seems to me that your position is if it's not listed as one of those three categories, then there is no authority to consider the environmental impact. But is what in 281.34.4 removes the DNR's discretion to consider the environmental impact in situations other than these three? And that ties me into 150, I think. But.
It does, and let me answer that in two ways. First of all, currently the DNR's rules don't require that. So if that's the question.
Don't require what?
Don't require environmental review for high-capacity wells.
Do they allow it?
Well, on a Type 4 action, it's only allowed under extraordinary circumstances.
Let's take a
look.
Type
4 action is generally exempt from any environmental review.
Let's take a look at the wording of the regulation that we're referring to and see if it's only allowed on extraordinary circumstances. And that would be Natural Resources 150.20, sub 2, sub B. And it says as follows. Type 4 actions do not require environmental impact process, do not require a news release, and are otherwise exempt from the procedural requirements of this chapter. Then it continues, the next sentence is which is the sentence I emphasize. The department may prepare and distribute an EA on the proposed action to aid departmental decision-making if the department determines that critical resources are affected by proposed action or there may be substantial risk to human life, health, and safety. Doesn't that give the department discretion to consider the environmental effect, even if it isn't listed as one of the three under sub 4? This is one of the arguments that's advanced in the amicus, and so I'd like you to respond to that.
Well, I guess I would answer that in two ways. One is that a Type 4 action, and unfortunately I don't have the particular regulation in front of me, but a Type 4 action is defined as an action in which no environmental review is required. And yes, it is not an absolute prohibition, but it is a restriction that in almost all cases a Type 4 action is one in which that wouldn't be required. This statute...
It may not be required, but they certainly are authorized to do it under 150.22B if they, in their discretion, determine it necessary.
I think that is true, Your Honor. But I think that the other part of this is we look at environmental review in the context of what the environmental review process is for. It is to inform agency decision-making, and it is designed to complement the standards that the agency sets for those wells.
I don't want to be disrespectful, but you're at a point where I just want to make sure I've got what you're saying. You're saying that because it's a Type 4, and Type 4 actions do not require this environmental assessment. But under the language of 2B, even though Type 4 actions do not require the environmental assessment, the department in its discretion may conduct it under the circumstances set forth in 2B. Is that your position? Is that your argument?
I believe that that's what the rule says. There are circumstances in which that can happen.
Okay, so they are not required to for a middle-level well, but if circumstances are met, they're authorized to do it in their discretion, right?
I think in terms of the environmental review, that may be true, but I would like to go on to the next part.
Okay.
Environmental review doesn't exist for its own purpose. Environmental review exists in the context of informing agency decisions and according to the substantive standards of those particular permits. NEPA is not a substantive statute. It is a statute that provides information to inform agency decisions. So ultimately, whether the review is required or not, what we need to look at is what are those standards. And as I was saying, the standards in 281.34 and 281.35 are specific. I was mentioning that there was in Act 310 a different standard for these middle-class wells. There is also a different standard for public water supply wells. So in a case of a public water supply well that's within one of those areas, the environmental impact is balanced by public benefit. So that's why environmental review is done for those wells, because there are standards that relate to environmental review. Act 310 also created a groundwater advisory committee to advise the legislature about further changes. And so taken as a whole, what we have is a deliberative legislative choice here, that it wasn't carte blanche. It was specific standards for each category of well, choices that reflected a priority for public water supply, and choices regarding the scope of environmental review. It's not simply a minimum standards. It is a comprehensive scheme that is to deal with the regulation of high-capacity wells. And by that, I'm not suggesting that every well is regulated or subject to the same standards. To the contrary, what this statutory framework does is very carefully define the circumstances for how groundwater withdrawal is to be evaluated.
Counsel, you just talked about that they're not to be minimum standards. I want to go back to the administrative rule 150.20 that I was just referring to, and instead focus on sub 1 rather than 2B, because that uses the words minimum review process. As I look at sub 1, I interpret it to mean that the actions listed in 150.03, these type 4 actions, that what is done here is that the type list in NR 150.03 is to determine the minimum review process appropriate for the proposed action. How do you interpret that language in sub 1 that seems to suggest to me that what's set forth is just the minimum and not the whole ballpark?
Well, again, what we're looking at is the provisions in NR 150 that talk about how the department can do an environmental review.
Mm-hmm.
It does environmental review, and you know, the standards for environmental review within NR 150 provide the agency with fairly broad discretion. But again, that is not a review that occurs outside the context of a statutory framework. It is to inform what those statutory standards are. And the statutory standards are set forth in 281.34 and 35. And so for these middling category wells that involve an impact to a spring or an impact to trout streams, yes, you want to do an environmental review so that you can determine whether those standards are met. If you're in above 2 million gallons a day, you want to do environmental review so that you can determine whether those standards are met. But below those standards, outside of this regulatory framework, the statutory standards do not require environmental review, and so the department certainly could do that, but it's not doing it for the purpose of determining whether a standard is met or not. What I think that both the district and the DNR have argued is that, well, 281.12 provides this kind of umbrella authority that allows you to go beyond the standards in 281.34 and 35. I don't think that holds. First of all, 281.34 and 35 are not, again, these are the substantive standards now for granting the well, not the environmental review section. The substantive standards don't refer to minimum standards. They don't reference the public trust doctrine. And when you look at 281.12, what you find there is not an open invitation to add standards to that. What you have in 281.12 And let me read it to you because I think it's important. It says, Hub 1 says, the department shall have general supervision and control over the waters of the state. It shall carry out the planning, management, and regulatory programs necessary for implementing the policy and purposes of this chapter. It essentially tells the reader, read on. Find out what the department's charges are. And those charges are in 281, 34, and 35. And the Robinson case, which talks about that was not the change permit standards, is precisely on point in that regard. I would say that if what you were to do is use 281.12, or Justice Bradley, to use the NR150 to kind of expand what the standards are, you're going to run into some significant conflicts with the legislative choices that were made in 281.34 and 35. Let me just quickly highlight what those are. Number one, there are different standards for different categories of wells. The standards for wells above 2 million gallons a day are different than the standards for these middling wells. Second, the legislature provided a priority. It continued that priority for public water supplies by providing a different standard and different protection for public water supplies that were involved. And it did also tie in providing environmental review for those particular standards. And the real issue here under the Court of Appeals decision, and I think what's being urged by respondents, is this. If there's a remand that goes back to the DNR, if the DNR is asked to do an environmental review, what standards apply to the village as well? What standards are there? If I, as the applicant, am trying to establish whether I meet standards, what standards do I look at? Do I look at the significant environmental impact standard in sub 5C? Do I look at the balance of environmental benefit that occurs in sub 5B and D? Or do I use the 281.35 standard, the no adverse impact standard? Doing an environmental review doesn't solve those questions. We need to know what standards apply, and once you leave the legislative framework that's in 281.34, we have no basis to make those decisions. And it's not that the department doesn't know how to apply general standards. They do. But the question is, what are the standards that are going to apply to this well? I mean, ironically, one of the things that could happen if the Court of Appeals was upheld on this is that the village of East Troy's well, in an area that is not as sensitive, at least under the legislative framework, as a well in a spring, will not get the benefit of the public water supply balancing test that applies to the more sensitive waters. That's just an example of the kind of problem you have. So it's not enough to say we can do review. The question is, what are the standards that apply, and how do we apply them? If there's a remand, where do we go? And the problem with leaving 281, 34, and 35 is that there is no answer to that question.
Counsel, this is a problem that I have with your argument, so I need your help on it. It seems to me that your argument is that unless it's one of those three things in 281, 34, sub 4, end of inquiry, and that the department does not and cannot, or at least sometimes the argument is, does not and cannot do an environmental assessment. I use that word loosely. But the logical extension seems to be, if they can't consider the environmental impact, let's say there's a horrible environmental impact, just a horrible environmental impact, but it does not happen to be within one of the three elements set forth in 281.34.4. It's not located in a groundwater protection area. It's not the 95% rule. It doesn't affect, per se, a spring. Is it your position, then, that the well has to be built, and only then, after it's built, that the department can bring a nuisance action or something like that, so that then the consideration of environmental impact can be entertained?
Your Honor, I see my time is up. May I answer that question?
May I respond?
Thank you. I will try and make this short, three very short responses to this. Number one, graduated permits with thresholds below which we don't regulate are commonplace, and we make those decisions based upon the fact that that's what the legislature has determined is the threshold below which we typically don't have impacts, or we are going to set that. I mean, for example, we could have withdrawn 2 million gallons of water a day directly out of Lake Beulah, and there would be no permit requirement under 30.08, because 30.08, which regulates surface water withdrawals, doesn't regulate this. And an interesting case in the Wisconsin Association of Lakes brief, Chain of Lakes, was exactly that situation that held that there was no review. So this happens all the time, and it happens for good reason, because that's the threshold beyond which we typically don't expect those impacts. But if there was a case where you had an impact, you have two kinds of remedies. You have certainly common law remedies that would apply in the case of an actual impact, and you have 30.03, which this Court and others have acknowledged is a very broad remedy that gives the Department to take actions, not in a permitting context, but if there is a possible infringement in public waters, they can bring a 30.03 action.
When you said common law, you're referring to nuisance actions?
Yes, Your Honor. The process there is both very broad, and the existence of those remedies also has a preventative effect, because if we were, I think, in the words of the Lake District, absolutely certain that we were going to destroy the waters of the lake, which has never been the issue in this case, but if we had one of those cases, the prospect of those remedies are such that nobody, no village, is going to invest money in a well that they know is going to cause damage. That's not a prudent event. The fact of the matter is that the DNR has broad remedies through 3003, and there is no restriction on when those can be brought, and they're not part of the permit process. So if the DNR really believes that there is a threat to the public trust, 3003 provides them an adequate remedy. But it shouldn't be a situation where we simply engraft additional and nonspecific permit standards into a program in which the legislature has been very specific about what and how we should regulate high-capacity wells.
Thank you, Mr. Kent.
Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Lang, representing Lake Beulah Protective and Improvement Association.
Good morning, members of the court. My name is Dean Lang. I represent the Lake Beulah Management District in this case. I intend to divide my argument into three parts this morning. First, I intend to discuss the relevant information that the DNR had in its possession concerning potential negative impacts to Lake Beulah from the high-capacity well proposed by the village at the time the DNR issued its permit in 2005. Second, I'll discuss the affidavit of Mr. Nauta and why it was properly a part of the agency record in this case. And third, I'll discuss the authority and duty of the DNR and what it had in light of that information at the time it issued that permit. Let me begin with what information the DNR had. And the reason I begin with this is because it's important to understand that this is not a case where people are saying could have, should have, might have. This is a case where the DNR, at the time they issued the permit in 2005, had hard evidence that this well will create potential serious problems at Lake Beulah. They had that information from four different sources. Some of those were private, some were governmental agencies, some were quasi-governmental agencies. And they had those in their possession as of September 6, 2005. The first thing it had is something that the village provided to the DNR. And that was a 2003 report from Lane Northwest Company, a private geological firm, which states that this well will not cause any serious disruption of groundwater discharge to Lake Beulah. Now, that report is not part of the record here, but that report is quoted in the permit issued by the DNR to the village. While the word serious is not defined in the letter, it obviously indicates this, there's going to be some disruption of groundwater discharge to Lake Beulah. We just don't know how much from that report. The second thing the DNR had is an August 4, 2005 affidavit of Robert Nauta, a Wisconsin licensed geologist retained by the district. In Mr. Nauta's affidavit, at paragraphs 20 and 21, he talks about the test done by Lane Northwest, and he explains it was only done at about half the rate and only for 72 hours. And he said, but even that test demonstrated that the wetland was lowered by about 0.2 foot during the relatively short period of that testing.
Now, was that in the 2005 record?
I will address that next, Your Honor, but it was not physically in the record submitted by Judy Ohm to the court. But the answer to your question is yes, it was part of the record, and that has been determined by the court, trial court as well as the Court of Appeals, and I'll address that shortly. In paragraph 29 of Mr. Nauta's affidavit, he indicates that test conducted by Lane Northwest clearly demonstrates potential for adverse impacts to Lake Beulah. He goes on to say, moreover, those tests clearly demonstrate interruption or disruption of groundwater supply to Lake Beulah and a diversion of surface water from Lake Beulah, which are likely to cause adverse effects to the lake. Finally, he concludes unequivocally in paragraph 31 of his affidavit, it is my opinion that the existing data can only support the conclusion that pumping of proposed well number 7 would cause adverse environmental impacts to the wetland and navigable surface waters of Lake Beulah. The third thing the DNR had in its possession when it issued the permit is a June 2002 email from Daniel Feinstein of the United States Geological Society, which was attached to Mr. Nauta's affidavit, where he, too, calls the test submitted by the village to the DNR, prepared by Lane, suspect. And that was his word. In paragraph 5 of his email, he indicates there's no question that pumping from the test well has an effect on Lake Beulah. He goes on to talk about even that test shows that after 2 years, there'd be a 2-foot drawdown adjacent to the lake if we assume what they assumed in the test. And then he concludes, the analysis conducted by Lane is suspect. Finally, the DNR had in its possession a 2003 letter from Philip Evanson of SewerPAC, which was likewise attached to Mr. Nauta's affidavit. And that letter, in paragraphs 3 and 5, indicate that they agree there will be potential for negative impacts if this well begins pumping. They say the well construction being considered, as well as the subdivision construction itself, will have the effect of reducing the groundwater flow to the lake. SewerPAC then recommends that the well not begin operation until adequate and proper tests are considered.
What should the test be? How will someone know if they have a well that they can go ahead and use, or if they have a well that's going to offend somebody or they're going to think affects their lake rights, because anytime there's a well, it could potentially affect. It's just maybe a little, maybe a lot, maybe a medium amount. What's it have to be?
Well, here, because it's a high-capacity well, there needs to be a permit in the first instance. The permit, as the Court of Appeals said, is not a rubber stamp process. It's required to submit a permit so that the DNR can approve it. At the point the DNR looks at it, this is their experience bailiwick. This is where they have the knowledge. In this case, we have documented evidence in affidavit form that this well will cause adverse impact to the lake. So in this case, it seems to me the DNR needs to do something. They can't just put their head in the sand and proceed forward, issue the permit, and then, as the village says, let's play this game where we issue a permit on one day, knowing it's going to create a problem, and on the next day we file an enforcement action to revoke what we did yesterday. So that the test here is whether there's going to be negative impact to the lake. In this case, the four pieces of information that the DNR had is unanimous that there will be impact. The question becomes, how much impact?
Well, if I understood the briefs, counsel, one of the issues, and as I understand it, you're really into what I have labeled in my mind as the second issue, assuming that the DNR has the authority to act here. Did they have enough evidence to, or is there enough evidence in here that they should be acting, and it goes back to them? The Court of Appeals said, yes, there was, and sent this back, right?
Yes.
But the fight here is at the tail end of all these briefs in a few pages as to what the DNR knew or should have known. And the fight also appears to me to be, and when did they know it? And there was a lot of reliance on the NORDA affidavit, which counsel knew about it in the 2003 proceeding, but was not specifically in the record in 2005. So my question for all of the items you have given us is, if I am just going to look at the 2005 record, that's all we're going to have here, I think, this says that there is a separate box. Maybe there are even more than one separate box. What am I going to find that substantiates your position that there's something in the DNR record that would lead them to believe they've got to further investigate this?
And that was my next section of my argument, Your Honor. To address your preliminary comment, when in 2003 the DNR had the Lane Northwest report, which indicated there was going to be disruption of groundwater. The sewer pack letter that I referenced in 2003 was also directly submitted to the decision makers at the DNR, and you can see the last copy of that letter there is to the southwest region of the DNR.
2003?
In terms of the NOT affidavit and the USGS email, those two things were provided to counsel for the DNR on August 4 of 2005.
In this proceeding?
It depends on how you define in this proceeding.
That's why I asked the question.
I understand. Let me back up about a month before that date. On August 3, 2005, Mr. Kent, representing the village, sent a letter to Judy Ohm, who's the in-house attorney for the DNR involved at the time, discussing well number 7 issues and then stating, quote, "The village is hereby requesting a modification of the existing permit to extend the date for 2 years," end quote. The very next And Ms. Ohm at the time was conferring with Mr. Kent about all of these issues. So she was really, in my view, wearing two hats at the time. Two hats she didn't like to wear, but because the DOJ wouldn't get involved, those were the hats she had. And she was talking about issues relating to the permit with counsel for the village, and she was also acting as litigation counsel in the cases that were then pending. The very next day, on August 4, 2005, the Lake District's predecessor counsel to me, David Meaney, filed Mr. Nauta's affidavit in court and provided a copy to Ms. Ohm. There's no dispute that she received it, and she got it on August 4. When Ms. Ohm submitted the record to the court, to the trial court in this case, she elected to include a copy of Mr. Kent's letter asking for the extension. But she elected not to include the affidavit that she got the very next day relating to the same parties, the same issue, the same well as part of that record. So what next happened is on May 1 of 2008, I filed two documents in the trial court. I filed a brief in support of the Lake District's petition for judicial review in this case and two other cases that were pending at the same time. And I filed a three-ring binder, which included Mr. Nauta's affidavit. And I did that intentionally in the two cases that were then pending. And as you can see on the binder that I submitted all of this stuff, including my brief, in all of the cases. And that's why I used the case caption I did. So it's submitted in this case and submitted in the other cases. The brief referred to Mr. Nauta's affidavit. The three-ring binder included a copy of Mr. Nauta's affidavit. After reviewing the brief and the binder, the trial court issued an order on July 28th of 2008. The order said we're going to proceed with this case first, and then the trial judge went on to explain what he would consider on the issue here. And he issued an order where he said the following. The court further notes that the record relied on the parties in support of their contentions in this case can include any information shown by the record to have been known to the DNR before and after the issuance of the 03 permit and up to the time they issued the 05 permit, as long as it is relevant to the claims the parties made in their pleadings in this case. The above is allowed because on judicial review, the court must determine if the DNR's decision to issue the 05 permit was a reasonable exercise of discretion under the relevant facts that the DNR was aware of as well as the applicable law. Now, a copy of that order is found at page 55 of the appendix I filed in this case. The trial court, in our view, clearly had the authority to make that ruling under section 227.55, which provides, quote, the court may require or permit subsequent corrections or additions to the record when deemed desirable. And that's precisely what the court did here. Subsequently, in the trial court's decision on the merits in this case, which was issued in September of 08, the trial court discussed Mr. Nauta's affidavit, but was misinformed on the facts relating to that. What the trial court said in its decision was this. There's no evidence the DNR had knowledge of Nauta's report when they issued the 05 permit. Just because Nauta's report is dated August 4, 05 doesn't mean it was disseminated before September 6, 05 to anyone, much less the DNR. The plaintiff cannot ask this court to judicially review a DNR permit decision based on evidence the DNR was not aware of or provided with before they issued the permit. Whether or not Nauta's report would have changed the DNR's mind is a moot question. Prior to that decision, the village moved to strike various documents from the record saying they weren't part of the official records submitted by Ms. Ohm. And I would point out, Your Honors, my client can't control what documents Ms. Ohm sends to the court. We can't control what's part of the record. She chose here to include Mr. Kent's letter requesting the permit, but not the Naught affidavit. We can't control that. All we can then do on judicial review is say to the trial court, we think you ought to consider it. And we did that, and the court did that here. The village then moved to strike a number of documents that were outside the record that were in my binder, and the trial court refused. And I'm referring now to record site 33 in this case. I sent a letter to the court after that talking about those motions to strike and motions to supplement. And I said this: while I agree with Mr. Kent that the court did not expressly rule on those motions, the court certainly indirectly did so by considering all of the materials submitted by the parties in connection with its oral decision. Accordingly, I request that the court simply leave the case in its present posture, and then I go on. The next day, on September 30, 2008, Judge Kennedy had a handwritten note. He kind of did a little jiggle line next to my paragraph and says, court agrees. But it didn't end there. Then we go up to the Court of Appeals, and the village files yet another motion to strike Mr. Nauta's affidavit. They made the same arguments they made.
If the Nauta affidavit is something that is either in the record by virtue of what you have submitted as a supplement or should be considered by the court for some other reason, what's your best argument about why that should cause us to affirm the Court of Appeals?
If you look at Mr. Nauta's affidavit, and I'll specifically refer to paragraph 31 because I think it's the most clear statement in the affidavit. Mr. Nauta says, it is my opinion that the existing data can only support the conclusion that pumping of proposed well number 7 would cause adverse environmental impacts to the wetland and navigable surface waters of Lake Beulah. At that point in time, the DNR had in its hands evidence in affidavit form indicating that this well will cause adverse impact to the lake.
You keep referring to 227.55. Is that right? Not 227.56?
You are correct, Your Honor. And the reason why I'm referring to 55 is because 55 refers to broad discretion the trial court has to essentially modify the records submitted to either make corrections or additions. If you go on to 56, 56 is really taking additional evidence, which we weren't asking.
I understand that. I understand that. But isn't one of the issues whether this affidavit is part of the record? I mean, isn't that the, misunderstanding what the issue is here?
Well, this statute, 227.55, says the court may require or permit subsequent additions or corrections to the record when deemed desirable. We acknowledge that Ms. Ohm decided not to file Mr. Nauta's affidavit as part of the record, which is why we asked the trial court to correct that and to make an addition to
that. So you view this as part of the 2005 record?
Yes. The Court of Appeals then was asked by the village.
So you don't have to rely on the Court of Appeals or any other court saying that the basis for sending this back to DNR is that the DNR is held to know everything that all of its agents know, including its lawyer.
We do not need to rely on that. We did not make that argument in the Court of Appeals. Not that I think that argument's wrong, because I think that's a common sense argument that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But our argument really is two-pronged. It is part of the record. That's what happened here, factually. And number two, if the court would disagree with that, the Court of Appeals position is based in common sense. When somebody's wearing two hats and you give somebody a document wearing one of the hats, it's imputed to her. She was the DNR. She was the face of this permit issue for the parties here. The Court of Appeals then, in an order issued on June 2 of 2009, indicated they denied the motion to strike it, and they said that the reason they denied it is because that affidavit was considered by the trial court. The trial court said it wasn't going to use it for certain reasons, and the trial court also denied the request to strike the documents. And so that was the Court of Appeals order in this case in 2009.
Why didn't Attorney Ohm include that as part of the record?
I don't know. Never got an answer.
Did Attorney Ohm play a role in issuing the 2005 permit?
Yes. She played a role. If you look at, for example, the first letter from Mr. Kent, and there's also, you'll see in, I think it's record 19, you'll see Mr. Kent and Ms. Ohm had a bunch of dialogue by email and by letter as well. And what they were trying to do here is make sure that the Lake District never got a hearing. And that was very important to them. So they said, let's not call this a new permit. Let's call this an extension. And then if we call this an extension, they won't have any right to get any hearing. Okay? And so there was then emails going back and forth, and then there's also an email in there from Mr. Kent to his client explaining what Ms. Ohm's position was, and ultimately they both agreed that this is a good idea. Let's call this an extension so that the Lake District then can't have a hearing, and that's exactly what they say. They weren't pulling punches or playing games. They said, we don't want this situation to escalate where they can have another hearing and put in evidence and delay things, they said. Let's just call this an extension. Now, here, Ms. Ohm is the DNR employee who was given Mr. Kent's letter. She received it. She put that as part of the record. She was given the affidavit of Mr. Nauta. Didn't put it part of the record. As the Court of Appeals says, it's a little perplexing why she wouldn't have passed it on to the decision makers. But we don't know if she did or not. We don't know whether she handed that affidavit.
Well, I thought you said that she was one of the decision makers.
She was involved in the process. I don't know if she was a decision maker in terms of the person making the ultimate decision. I don't know that. She was involved in the whole process. And in this record, we don't know who the decision makers were. We don't know if Ms. Ohm gave the affidavit to those people, whoever they might be. We just don't know that. What we know is that it didn't get in the file that she submitted to the trial court. That's what we know. And we don't have a lot of answers as to whether that was given to decision makers, who the decision makers were, or we don't have any answers as to why she submitted what she did as part of the agency record. From our
what is the implication if this affidavit never reached the decision makers?
Well, I would say two things. Number one, I would be concerned if I was the DNR decision makers that they didn't have relevant information in front of them that was in the DNR's hands that may have and probably would have swayed their decision one way or the other. In terms of this case, if you're asking me if the court finds that this is not part of the official agency record, what's the implication? I would say still nothing, because we have the Lane Northwest report from 03, which they had in their hands. Now, that's not part of the record either, but the reference to it and what it said is part of the record in the permit. We also know that the DNR received the sewer PACs letter where they made their statements that I've referenced in 2003. So we know that at a minimum the decision makers had those two things, which is enough to say I can't bury my head in the sand. I can't just ignore it and say, okay, the process says I have to issue a permit, but I can't consider anything here because it's less than 2 million gallons per day, so I can't consider anything, so I need to put my head in the sand, issue the permit, and then the next day think about it. Okay. So in our opinion, they had enough information in 2003 to raise the red flags, and they did nothing about it. And we don't know by this record why. Why did the DNR simply ignore things that they had in their possession? Or didn't they ignore them? Did they consider them? We don't know that.
Do you have some burden to establish whether the DNR considered that or not?
We can't have any burden on that, Your Honor, because there's it wasn't part of the record. It then became part of the record. The only thing there's no way for us to demonstrate that. There's no discovery to be taken in this case. There was no discovery taken in this case. There's no way we can establish that. The only thing I can tell you is that oral argument at the Court of Appeals, Ms. Ohm, who was then representing the DNR, was asked some of those very questions along the line of what Justice Braddy was asking Mr. Kent on NR 150 and about the process here, about if she admits receiving it, about those kinds of things. So that's the only thing that we have in this case that would give us any guidance at all on that issue. My time is close to being up. I've got a couple minutes, so let me move now to the third issue, and I think my two able colleagues are going to properly address those issues. But I would just say this on this topic. If you look at Section 281.12 sub 1, that is not, unlike the Rusk case and some other situations, a statute that just is a statement of policy and purpose. That's found in 281.11. 281.12 specifically says the DNR shall have general supervision and control over the waters of the state, period. And you can start there and end there, in our view. That is a specific power and authority granted by the legislature to the DNR. They are the ones that have general supervision and control over the waters of the state. Then it goes on to say, and what should they do? They should carry out the policy and purpose of the subchapter, or of this chapter. If you go to 281.11, you then see what the policy and the purpose is, and they talk about managing and improving and maintaining and protecting the waters of this state, ground and surface, public and private.
Counsel, what is your argument here? The Court of Appeals casts your argument as in kind of absolute terms, not with regard to authority, but with regard to duty. That is, the Court of Appeals suggests that you are arguing that not only is there authority, but the DNR is required to do an environmental assessment. I hear you arguing here today, focusing on the affidavit and other information, that they are required to hear because of the information that was available to them. What is it? Did the Court of Appeals correctly cast your argument with regard to duty?
Our position is that in this case, there clearly was enough information to raise a red flag, without any question. Under the facts of this case, the antenna should have went up. They should have dug in and done something. There's no question. Our position is not, in every single case, they need to do a full-blown review process when there's no information or knowledge that they have or anybody else has presented to them. It's not as limited as to what somebody like the Lake District must provide them. If the DNR has that information from here, the Lane Northwest report, for example, somebody should ask somebody.
Counselor, the question I think was whether there's a duty in this case. Okay, so if we buy all the stuff you're telling us about the information the DNR had, did they have a duty? They had the opportunity, okay, and perhaps the authority, if we buy your argument, but did they have a duty? And if your answer is yes, what do you rely on for that?
And maybe I misunderstood the question. Yes, in our position, from our position, there's no question they had the authority and the duty to act here. And the reason they had the duty to act here is because whether it's under the statutes, Chapter 281, whether it's under the DNR regs, whether it's under the Public Trust Doctrine, once they have that information that there could potentially be here, there was evidence that there will be damage. they need to act and do an analysis. And from that point forward, then there can be hearings, et cetera, going down the road. But they need to act immediately. They cannot blindly just ignore that.
So you're not relying on a particular statutory section, but rather the DNR's overall responsibility under the Public Trust Doctrine?
Well, Chapter 281, or Section 281.12, okay, which, in our view, kicks in application of the Public Trust Doctrine.
Okay, thank you.
Chief, if I may, just for clarification, you said under the statute, under the regs, and the Public Trust Doctrine, you've enumerated the statute. What reg are you referring to with regard to duty?
Your Honor, prior to the argument at the Court of Appeals, the DNR regs, the one you referenced, were not cited in any brief. Okay. At oral argument, the Court of Appeals asked Ms. Ohm a number of questions, and Ms. Ohm indicated at that point that the DNR had the authority under that reg section to act. What I'm telling you is, in fairness, we didn't brief that issue. We didn't cite that issue. In reviewing that reg, we believe that Mr. Kent is absolutely correct when he told you today that the DNR is not required but is certainly authorized to do so under that reg. And we share that opinion. Here, we believe they're required to because of the facts that they had in their possession. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Attorney Carl A. Sindebrand, representing the State of Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Carl Sindebrand from Axley Brynelson here in Madison, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. To the other parties in this case, the issue is whether the village gets to use a well or whether additional investigation has to be done to determine whether the village gets to use a particular well and under what circumstances. On that issue, DNR is on record as having approved the well and rejected the challenge. That is, DNR's position is that the village prevails under our application of the law to this case. And the village's reinvention of public trust law is not necessary for it to prevail. For that reason, we'd ask the court to consider addressing the administrative record issue, the issue primarily discussed by Mr. Lang, first, in that it may obviate the need to decide the Chapter 281 issues. DNR's interest in this case is of more significant and enduring importance because it relates to our authority, our responsibilities, and how the administrative procedures are supposed to work in the state of Wisconsin, not just for DNR, but for all agencies in the state.
Counsel, just for clarification, you suggest in your comment that perhaps what I'll call issue number two might be dispositive, and you wouldn't have to get to what I would call issue number one, the authority. Tell me why you say that before you start your argument, if you would. Why issue number two, the record issue, so to speak, might be dispositive.
Sure. The state of Wisconsin has a longstanding and clearly defined system in place for making decisions, obtaining judicial review, and ensuring that the record is complete. It is all found within Chapter 227. The agency makes its decision through either a contested or non-contested case proceeding. Individuals who want the agency to consider pertinent information have the authority to submit it to the decision makers. People who are adversely affected by the decision can either request a contested case hearing or seek judicial review. In the context of judicial review, there are at least three opportunities to expand or correct the record. One is to ask the court to under 227.55. Another is to move the court to take additional testimony under Section 227.56. And the third is to ask the agency to remand the case to DNR to take additional testimony or evidence under 227.57. It's either sub 1 or sub 2. The petitioners, original petitioners in this case, the Lake Buellah Management District, did none of those. They did not seek a contested case hearing. They did not ask DNR to consider the NADA affidavit in the context of the 2005 proceeding. They did not move the court to expand the record. They did not move the court to take additional evidence. They did not move the court to remand it to DNR for purposes of considering that that evidence. They missed all these opportunities. For agencies, we can't abide by somebody submitting something somewhere, and all of a sudden it's imputed to the knowledge of the agency, and it has to be considered.
I know this is really not part of your argument. Your legal argument about the power of the DNR is more important. So just very quickly, who submitted the NADA affidavit?
Let me address two issues, if I may, in that regard, because there was pre-existing information submitted by the village prepared by Lane Northwest. That was submitted in the context of the 2003 permit, or excuse me, approval. DNR approved the approval. It went to judicial review. Everybody had their day in court, and the court affirmed the decision. So whatever's in the 2003 NADA and sewer pack is not really at issue. It's the NADA affidavit. And here's how the NADA affidavit came to be.
Came to be in the 2005 now.
How it came to be an issue in this case.
Okay.
Correct. In the 2003 action, the court, Judge Kennedy, Judge Carlson, I believe, affirmed the 2003 approval. The Lake Buellah Management District then moved for reconsideration. And as part of their motion for reconsideration, they submitted the NADA affidavit with its attachments and told the court, if you'd consider this or if you'd remand this, this is illustrative of the type of information we would submit to the DNR. I believe it was 2 days later, the court, sua sponte, summarily denied the motion for reconsideration, handwritten note on the cover letter saying no. Now, as attorneys, our lives are a lot like triage, and that you deal with the things you have to deal with. So this motion comes in to Ms. Ohm's office, presumably with the affidavit attached. I don't know that she looked at the motion that day or the next day, but by the time she got to it, it had already been denied. That's now something she doesn't have to deal with. It's moot. So I'm not sure that Ms. Ohm ever even looked at that affidavit because it was submitted in another lawsuit on a prior permit that was rejected immediately by the court. And that illustrates why it's so important to agencies that we abide by the process in Chapter 227, just as it's important to the judiciary to abide by the requirements of Chapter 227 for judicial review, and of course the rules of civil procedure and local rules for other kinds of cases. And therein lies the rub.
And the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, if I've got it right, treat the 2005 as a new permit, not an extension of the 2003.
Correct. At the time it was submitted to DNR, Ms. Ohm said, well, we've got an existing permit. This isn't changing anything. They just want to extend it. We're going to consider it as an extension. The Court of Appeals ultimately decided it was a new permit. And so that's the background, the story on what happened with the NADA affidavit. And that's why it's so troubling to us that someone who doesn't follow the process that everybody's required to follow somehow gets a better advantage. And what message does that send to potential litigants?
Well, as I understand your position, you're here to correct that part of the Court of Appeals, supporting that part of the Court of Appeals, relating to the DNR authority.
Correct.
But not relating to the remand to the DNR.
Correct.
Okay, so let's get to the first issue.
Thank you. And Mr. Kent, when he talked about the first issue, started with, you know, sort of recent history on the statutes, some of which is and some of which is not legislative history. I'd like to step back a little bit because for us at DNR, this is cases about protecting Wisconsin's surface water resources. And in particular, both the constitutional and legislative mandate that DNR is the agency of the state that balances the needs of businesses, citizens, visitors, municipalities who have competing interests and rely on those waters for both their economic prosperity and our quality of life. Wisconsin's water resources are critical to our quality of life and to our economy. Our public waters define our history, our demography, our industry, our recreation, and our reputation. They support our dairy industry, our agriculture, tourism, and a host of other water-based industries.
Council, I don't disagree with anything you're saying right now. I'm Good. Still stuck on what you were saying a minute ago, and you just have to clarify something for me. If it is an extension, would they have the right to ask for a hearing or submit documentation or do all that? Or does it change when it's a new permit? Do you have different rights with a new permit that you may not otherwise have with just an extension of a permit? Do you follow what I'm saying?
I understand your question.
Is it different, and how would that impact what someone might submit or resubmit to you, depending on whether it's an extension or a new permit?
I think the answer is that the department would have to look at the criteria in Section 227.42 for the grant of contested case hearings and determine whether the applicant qualifies. And it's not particularly relevant whether it's an extension or a new permit. Now, new permit implies that things are going to be something different. And here we had a situation that, but for the timing of it, was de facto an extension because nothing was going to change in the department's analysis. When it was issued, there was no request for a contested case hearing under Section 227.42. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
When the 05 or the 03 was issued?
When the 03 permit was issued, there was a request for a contested case hearing. It ultimately didn't happen for a variety of reasons. When the 05 permit, the one on appeal here, was issued, there was no request for a contested case hearing.
Okay, so what would they have had to do to get the NADA affidavit in front of you and get a hearing?
File a petition for a contested case hearing under Section 227.42, which is the way everybody asks for a contested case hearing, unless there is a specific statute elsewhere that governs. That would have given them the right to a contested case hearing and to litigate this whole issue.
So then if you have a contested case hearing, I understand that you have the requirement to approve high-capacity wells, right?
Yes.
And what is the authority to review the approval is my next question. And then what standard would they have to meet if they asked for this hearing and they did have a contested hearing? What is the standard? What's the burden that they would have to meet to show, boy, you blew it in issuing this permit?
Okay. The procedures for requesting contested case hearings and the implementation of that or the administration of the process is for DNR. Every agency has their own rules. In DNR, it's Chapter NR2. And you submit the petition. The petition is granted or not denied based on allegations. You don't have to submit evidence in support of your petition. And then the process is a judicial-type hearing in front of an independent administrative law judge who then ultimately makes the decision with a few unique exceptions that can apply. And then there's a right to judicial review of that. The burden of proof in a contested case hearing is typically on the party challenging the approval or the permit. And so it would have been...
But what would it be? It affects our lake water a little bit. It affects our lake water a lot. It affects it...
Well, that gets into the substantive question of my argument in terms of what are the standards that apply to the DNR, regardless of a contested case hearing. What standards apply to DNR in evaluating whether there is a sufficient impact to warrant additional review or some conditions to the approval? And I can, it's sort of a backwards part of my argument, but I'll address your question right now.
Thank you.
DNR operates under multiple statutes in which it does a public interest impact on navigability type of review. Chapter 30 is replete with those requirements. Chapter 293 relating to mining has those. Chapter 281 and 283 relating to water quantity and water quality, if you will, has those public interest rights in navigable waters type analysis.
Right, but
this is something we've done.
You have to build the well first, and then you either file a nuisance action or a 3003.
That is their position.
And after the fact, oh, I guess you were right, it impacts our lake water.
That is their position on the core issue of whether DNR has authority under 281.12 to evaluate and affect the outcome of a well approval decision.
So is that true? Once you approve it, that's it? It's approved until it's later proven to be destructive?
No, our position is just the opposite, Your Honor. Our position is that the requirements of 281.34 are minimum requirements, and that DNR retains the express authority, it's general, but it's express, in 281.12 to evaluate any application for impacts to navigable waters. That's the core of our position, and if you treat 281.34 as minimum requirements, which the language of 281.34 indicates, then there is no conflict. It is only if you conclude that the legislature implicitly revoked its own express delegation to DNR under 281.12 that you get a conflict. The core of Mr. Kent's argument is that in adopting 281.34 with those requirements, the legislature implicitly decided that we are pulling back on DNR's legislatively delegated authority to protect surface waters. To me, that doesn't make sense, and it defies a whole host of rules of statutory construction.
And so as for Mr. Lang's argument, you're saying, you know what, if you would have timely asked for a hearing, we would have given you one and made those determinations. You could have appealed that to circuit court, but you didn't timely ask for that, so don't ask for it now. Is that the long and the short of it?
That's with some subtle distinctions. I don't know if he would have gotten a hearing, but certainly that would have been the avenue to ask for one, yes. And if the NADA affidavit in the judgment of DNR had legitimacy, then yes, then he would have gotten a contested case hearing. And if he had asked the court to take additional evidence or to expand the record or to remand it to DNR, the court would have decided that. But yes, that's...
Thank you.
You got the point. Right.
Got it.
Thank you.
Just for clarification on that point, you don't have to ask for a contested hearing. You can just go right to a judicial review under 227, can't
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely.
So that's
Absolutely.
An alternative. It's not like you have to, and if you don't ask for it, then you're out of luck. That's a 227 judicial review is an alternative instead of asking for a contested
case hearing. That's exactly correct. In fact, folks who want contested case hearings because of the timing typically file both a contested case hearing request and an action for judicial review to make sure they've got their case, they don't miss deadlines.
And an action for judicial review is what was filed here in the 2005 permit case.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct.
May I ask a question? I'm trying to understand your argument. We have permits for some high-capacity wells, and wells where there's between 100,000 and 2 million gallons per day do require a permit. Is that right?
An approval, yes.
Okay. But if there is a well that's less than 100,000, no permit is required.
Correct. There is a submittal that's required, but it is not an approval process.
Now, with your analysis, are you saying that notwithstanding the fact that the statute does not require an approval, the Department of Natural Resources has authority to govern these wells of under 100,000 gallons per day capacity?
No. Because of the way 281.34 is structured, as a practical matter, DNR typically wouldn't even find out about those non-high-capacity wells until they're constructed and the notice is submitted. So, you know, just the way things work on the ground, there'd be no way for DNR in this structure to exercise advanced jurisdiction over wells unless they are high-capacity wells.
Well, but it seems to me you're assuming that we decide this issue simply on the basis of no knowledge on the part of the DNR. Suppose the DNR did have knowledge. Someone complained about it.
Well, if someone complained about it, it would have to be after the fact that somebody's been impacted. When we're talking about these smaller wells, we're talking about things like private potable water supply wells, you know, farm wells to feed the herd. Even those might be over 100,000 gallons per day. So there are very few of them, and they are the types of wells that it would be in rare instances that it would even come to DNR's attention that one was being installed. It happens every day by well drillers. Now, there are requirements associated with the drilling and placement and location of those wells, and those are set forth in NR 812, which incidentally was not promulgated under 281.34. So the notion that this is an exclusive, all-contained statute is wrong from that account as well. But those are kind of self-executing. Well drillers, you have to comply with this. It is not an active regulatory authority. So, you know, the notion of what happens to the small wells really isn't at issue here, sir. For the other wells, it's clear from the way the statute is written that these were intended to be consistent with the directive of the legislature in 281.11 and 281.12, that DNR, you are the trustee and you have to manage your programs consistent with the public trust requirements. Because when we're looking at whether a statute is exclusive or minimum or illustrative standards, we have to look at the language of the statute. If the statute says, if you comply with these requirements, DNR shall issue the permit, and that does exist in some statutes, then that's exclusive. That's mandatory. You comply, DNR issues. This is not how this is written. This is written to say that if the department determines that a proposed high-capacity well will impair a public water supply, you can't approve. Doesn't say DNR, you don't have any other authority. It's just a restriction on its existing authority to approve or not a well. And so it's not written, the language of it does not suggest or indicate that it's exclusive. And, of course, if it were exclusive, then we've got this conflict that we've got to deal with. We interpret statutes to harmonize and not to create conflict, and that is a fundamental flaw in the village's argument under Chapter 281.
What language are you specifically relying on to make that argument?
I'm looking at 281.34, subsection 5. If the department determines that a proposed high-capacity well may impair the water supply of a public utility engaged in furnishing water to or for the public, the department may not approve the high-capacity well unless it includes provisions that that will ensure that the public water, that the water supply of the public utility will not be impaired. Okay. I paraphrased it a little bit.
I was reading along.
Yeah, but that's the language. That's written as a very limited restriction on the department's authority. Now, there are...
Just interrupt again.
Sure.
When you talked about 281.12, you said this was express authority to evaluate the implication on navigable waters. What waters are we talking about? Lake Beulah?
In this particular case, we're talking about Lake Beulah.
Okay,
yes.
Fine. Right. So that's where our focus is. That's where you get to the public trust, because the public trust talks about navigable waters.
Correct.
I mean, is that right?
Yes, okay. That's exactly correct.
Thank you.
Now, a couple other comments I'd like to make about the way 281.34 works. First of all, this is not some new or novel interpretation that the department is going to look at potential impacts on public resources, in particular navigable waters. In fact, in the 2003 permit or approval, as we've heard this morning, the village submitted a report from Lane Northwest which specifically evaluated whether there was going to be any adverse impact on navigable waters. This is something that historically DNR does all the time with both businesses and municipalities. And here's the reason. I'm going to separate business and municipality. For a business, if I need to withdraw 500,000 gallons per day, I don't want to find out a year after I've made the investment and made my business plan and built my well, constructed my well, that because of impacts to surface waters, DNR is going to be coming after me after the fact under 3003 or nuisance and say, you can't have your 500,000 gallons. You can only have 300,000 gallons. That would be very dangerous to our system. For municipalities, we have the obligation to have enough wells and enough capacity to meet the regulatory standards for public water supplies. Again, for a municipality to say we need 500,000 gallons per day out of this well, make the public investment, meet the standards, and then find out later that now we're going to have to restrict what we can use that well for, that's a huge, at least partially wasted investment of public resources, and now they have to go find another well. So the practice is and has been and should be that the parties provide their technical information and work with DNR to create as much certainty as they can that what they're going to get in the approval is what they're going to be allowed to operate at. Someone has to be the central unit of government for making these kinds of decisions, and the legislature clearly and unequivocally said it's DNR. Now,
when an application is filed, and let's say there's some expert report that's attached that says there will be no environmental harm to the lake nearby, what responsibility, if any, does the DNR have to go above that assertion? Or does it say, oh, here's the application, that's the assertion, rubber stamp?
No. I understand your question. DNR's obligation and its mission is to protect water resources, groundwater as well as surface waters, but here we're talking about surface water impacts, not groundwater impacts. When DNR receives a report like the Lane Northwest report, It is going to scrutiny. I mean, they're engineers and hydrogeologists at DNR. They have the technical expertise. They scrutinize that report. Does that report make sense? Is it complete? Is the database on which it relies adequate? Is there something we're missing here? So if DNR gets a report for a well that's, say, within 1,400 feet or 1,200 feet, as in this case, and the geologic medium is highly fractured bedrock or sand through which water travels very quickly, they're going to be very concerned and scrutinize that from a technical standpoint so they can exercise their judgment. If it's dense clay and it's that much separation and there's no apparent hydraulic connection between the aquifer at issue and the surface water at issue, then it's less of a concern. In DNR gets applications for somewhere between 250 and 300 high-capacity wells, less than 2 million gallons per day water loss per year. They don't want to. They don't have the resources. They can't scrutinize every application and do an analysis and the necessary modeling to evaluate the impacts. This is a type of authority that's used rarely, judiciously, and when necessary to serve the mission of protecting water resources. I hope that answered your question.
So when DNR gets one of those applications, do they provide notice to the people who may be affected so they have the opportunity to object and request a hearing?
This program does not have a notice requirement. Typically,
some do, and
this one doesn't. Typically, people do know about it because, for example, if it's a municipality, there's going to be public notice that the municipality is going to spend $1 million, $2 million, whatever amount
of
money.
That municipalities, people who live there, but maybe not to the people who live on Lake Beulah?
Well, Lake Beulah is very close to East Troy, and it's
right.
It's not. It's if I lived in Stoughton or Fitchburg, and the city of Madison is proposing some large expenditure, I know about it. I mean, it's that, again, practically on the ground, how does this work? People know. So, but you are correct. I mean, in your question, that it is not there is no notice specifically required by statute or rule for this program. A couple of other points I'd like to make. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm out of time.
Mr. Sunderbrand.
Justice Prosser.
Frankly, for me, the specter is being created that the Department of Natural Resources granted a permit that is going to do great damage to Lakeview. Am I getting a wrong picture?
That is the allegation. Yes, sir. We have no evidence that the well has been in existence for several years now. Nobody has brought a nuisance action. Nobody has brought to the attention of the department that there is a problem associated with water levels in Lake Beulah attributable to this well. And at this point in time, the remedies suggested by Mr. Kent would be the remedies that the tools that are available. If the information had been timely submitted and correctly submitted to DNR, and DNR had found that information, sufficiently grounded that it ought to investigate, then it would have. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Sunderbrand. Attorney Kent, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. Just a couple of things. Justice Rogensack, I do have a reference for you on the interbasin diversion 281.35, the sister statute to 281.34. Paren 1, Paren G, talks about interbasin diversions between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi.
Yeah, I found that. They denominate it, though, a Great Lakes basin, They don't just say basin, but I understand your context.
But it was an interbasin.
Interbasin transfer.
Yes,
right. I got
exactly.
It. Thank you for the help, though.
I do want to reiterate a couple of things. First of all, in terms of the record, there was a lot of discussion about that. I just want to clarify a few things. When the village applied for the 2005 approval, we submitted a new application and a fee, and while we would just as soon as it was an extension, in fact, what the department did was it issued a new decision, complete with hearing rights, mailed it to the council for the district. So it was a reviewable decision, hence the 227 review, but they could have asked for a contested case hearing. They did not. The other thing that I would just note very briefly is that, yes, the NADA affidavit shows up in the record, but as part of the other case, not this case, in my appendix and in my brief, I have the reference to the motions Mr. Lang filed under 227.55. Those were not made in this case.
I don't have it in front of me, but the argument is advanced that you made it in the 2005 permit. When it got to the court, you made a motion to strike certain things on the record, and they made a motion, your opposing counsel made a motion to supplement the record. They advance that although their motion did not specify the NADA affidavit per se, as I understand the argument, it did encompass in reference to it in their brief, and also they submitted materials to supplement the record. Did they make a motion to supplement the record in the 2005 proceeding?
They did, but it did not include the NADA affidavit, and the motion that they did make is in my appendix. What I do want to emphasize in terms of the substantive issue is two key points. One is 281.12 is not a carte blanche grant of authority to the department. And if it is, why have all of the attention in 281.34 and 35? Session after session, the legislature takes a look at what to do to regulate the withdrawal of water from high-capacity wells, and they establish advisory committees, and they go back, and they make careful incremental decisions. Why do all of that if 281.12 gives the department carte blanche authority? It doesn't. And to the extent it does, once the legislature has now chosen to establish this framework, you have a system with specific standards. None of the council have been able to answer the question that Justice Ziegler and others have asked. What standards apply? So I'm on remand. I go back. Yes, the department has experience interpreting the public interest. But what standard applies here? There is no standard. There's a variety of standards, each unique to specific circumstances and specific levels of pumping in specific locations. Those are all different standards. Those are specific legislative choices. Those standards and those choices ought to be upheld. I also think it's important to take a look at what these remedies are. 30.03 is not a toothless remedy. It allows the department to act, not as part of a permit proceeding, but as an independent enforcement matter whenever, at whatever time, it believes public trust resources are endangered. There is no reason why the department couldn't have used that if they found that there was some egregious problem coming up. But that's not our case. It's not our case, and as Mr. Sindebrand correctly noted, in the 2.5 years that this well has been pumping, we have not had a nuisance action, a 3003, or anything else. And why is that? It's because, in part, we also, as a village and as a responsible municipal entity, do exactly what Mr. Sindebrand talked about any permittee doing, not because it's part of the permit process, but because it's part of the process to avoid a nuisance action or a 3003 action, which is make sure that that well is not going to damage the lake. Because if it does, we have the potential for liability. That has not happened because the village did do their homework and there is no impact.
Thank you.
See, I'm out of time. If there's no other questions, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Kent. Thank you, Mr. Hildebrandt. I'm sorry. And thank you for to Mr. Lang for your arguments today in a case raising very interesting DNR issues. And in effect, the argument continues in a slightly different cast in the next case. So that ends our argument in 088P3170, Lake Beulah Management District versus Department of Natural Resources. Some of the students, I believe, will be leaving and others will be coming in, so we're going to take a few minutes of recess to allow a shift in the audiences here.